How's everybody?
Good.
Some of you came back. That's good. Some of you here for the first time. Tell me if that's good later. I appreciate that. Well, we're going to jump in with kind of where we left off yesterday. But before we do that, I just want to tell you, take this as an apology or however you want to take it. I must leave this room at 4:15 because I have a flight that I'm going to be really lucky to catch, as it is. And so I see some dear friends here in front of me that I want to say hello to before I leave. And so I'm probably going to try to finish up at about 4:10. That's my goal. So I can have a couple minutes to say hello. And so I'm going to try, as we did yesterday, throughout the lecture, if there are questions that you have, if there are comments that you want to make, by all means, as I said, this is a class, it's not a sermon. And so stop me, raise your hand, and we can dialogue about it. Because more than anything else, I want this material to be helpful. I want it to be constructive. I don't want this to just simply be disseminating information. If you'd like to dialogue about that, I would love for that to happen. But we'll try to do it in the context of the lecture rather than at the end. Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yes.
Can you finish at 4:05?
I could probably try to finish at 4:05.
All right.
Do you have somewhere to be?
No, you do. But at least it's not coming from you.
That's true. Well, I'm gonna try to get through some of this. This stuff we're going to talk about today is pretty eye-opening, I would say. A lot of times when I present this material, even people that have been in churches of Christ, even people who care deeply about race relationships within churches of Christ, some of this material they were completely unaware of. And it really causes a lot of questions. And so I'm trying to jump into that. And if you want to dialogue about that, we'll jump in. To recap a little bit yesterday, for those of you who are not here, we made the statement that throughout most of its history, within churches of Christ, there has been an illusion, key word, there's been an illusion of racial unity. And that illusion has been perpetuated by both whites and African Americans. Okay, and we went into detail on that yesterday. Don't have time to revisit all of it, but very quickly, largely whites within the movement of Churches of Christ up until the time of the Civil Rights Movement acted as if there was no race problem whatsoever. If you read the journals, if you attended the lectureships, if you went to the schools, white Churches of Christ, race problems were not mentioned. If your only orientation to America in that period was through white journals and colleges and lectureships in the Churches of Christ, you never would have known the Civil Rights Movement had taken place because it's never mentioned. On the other side of the movement, you had African Americans within the movement, chiefly people like Marshall Keeble, who we made a very important point yesterday, that out of necessity and pragmatically also perpetuated the illusion of racial unity. He was passive in the sense that he was very calculated, I think is the way to put that. He was very calculating because he was raising a lot of money for African-American endeavors and schools. And so he also, even though was a leader within the African-American community, he did not talk about racism either, at least publicly, openly. There are some stories that we know about privately where he did talk about these matters, and that really helps us get to the character of who Keeble really was. But that illusion of racial unity was maintained for much of the history of Churches of Christ. And I promised you yesterday that we were going to talk today about a time where that illusion was shattered. And so we're going to jump into that right now. In the early 1940s, there were 10 well-established white schools that existed within Churches of Christ. They were financially stable. They were moving forward. They had growing student bodies. But the same was not true for African-American members of Churches of Christ. But a couple of decades earlier, in the 1920s, there were some African-American citizens of Nashville that solicited funds from within other African-American congregations. They raised money from within their own communities, and they purchased a piece of land in Nashville for the purpose of building an African-American school. Now, remember, this was a time where they were not allowed in the white schools, so they were going to purchase land to build their own school. Several years later, they sold that property, and they, with the money that they received from the sale of that property, plus another $15,000, they built Nashville Christian Institute. School is in Nashville, Tennessee, or was in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a historical site now. NCI served as for Churches of Christ as an institution exclusively for the purpose of educating African Americans grades 1 through 12. Now, though this was not a Christian college, and we've been talking about Christian college and their roles within Churches of Christ, though it was not a Christian college, NCI functioned in much the same way for the African American community, because many successful African American preachers gained their education at NCI. And a lot of the teaching and the education they received there really spread into the movement. In fact, Marshall Keeble, who served as a longtime president of Nashville Christian Institute, he used this institution as a training ground for literally hundreds, maybe thousands, of African American ministers. R.N. Hogan, we mentioned yesterday, was a longtime preacher in this area, very influential leader in Churches of Christ. He was educated at the Nashville Christian Institute. He was also the longtime editor of Christian Echo, an African-American journal within Churches of Christ. Fred Gray, a name that some of you are very familiar with. If you're not, you need to know this. Fred Gray, African-American member of Churches of Christ, was highly influential, continues to be highly influential, not just in Churches of Christ, but in the world as an attorney. He was Rosa Parks' attorney, and he was Martin Luther King Jr.'s attorney. Was a very, very important individual. In fact, if you saw the movie recently released, Selma, there is somebody in the movie that plays Fred Gray. He was an important person in this movement, okay? And that's going to come back to great importance in a minute. Therefore, NCI, because of all these things, should properly be referred to as or considered, as much as it was a K through 12 institution, it was a preaching school. It was a training ground for preachers within Churches of Christ. And we talked yesterday about how our schools within the movement, lacking an overarching denominational structure the way Baptists or Presbyterians or Lutherans or Methodists may have, one of the things that has bound together our movement have been our institutions, have been our educational institutions, our colleges. And NCI served that function as well. It really did unite the movement in a very, very special way. It bound African-American congregations to other African-American congregations, and for a brief period, it also united African-American members and white members of the movement. Both African-American and white members of this denomination played a significant role in the maintenance and leadership of NCI after 1943. It was in that year a man named A.M. Burton, who was a very wealthy individual and philanthropist in America, a member of Churches of Christ, he became interested in NCI. And over the next 23 years, he provided really an untold amount of money from his own pocket to try to keep NCI moving as a school, made a lot of contributions to the school. But he also did something else. As he was giving contributions to the school, he also made a recommendation not long after he began helping the school that they change the makeup of its board of directors. Up until this time, the board of directors of NCI had been 10 African-American people. At Burton's suggestion, the makeup of that board was changed to 6 white, 4 African-American, which is key. Burton assumed the position of chairman of that board, and he retained that position until his death in 1966. This fundamental change in leadership did not go unnoticed by members of the African-American community. Though Burton's decisions could be construed as an attempt toward integration, many African-American leaders viewed the decision very differently, and perhaps No one said it better than Aaron Hogan, writing about this particular moment in the history, wrote this: under the guise of wanting to help the Negro, some white brethren who claimed to be Christians became members of our board of directors of the Negro school. He didn't buy the idea that this was about integration. This was a takeover. This is how it's construed and viewed among many folks within Churches of Christ. So these two segments of the denomination, African American and white, they function historically along two parallel lines. They were moving ahead. They rarely intersected. They had their own histories. They had their own organizations. They were moving in two parallel lines, and they touched briefly for a moment. And one of the places that they touched briefly was at NCI. Okay? So there are various ways they touch, largely because of Keeble's ability to move in and out of both worlds. He was a connecting point. NCI was a connecting point in that respect, and allowed them to at least converse briefly in those years. But as Hogan's statement indicates, this brief merge would give rise to increasing tension. As they became in contact with each other, some of the resentment began to spill out into the public. In fact, one could argue this tension finally catapulted when these two groups finally moved into two completely different religious groups at the end of NCI's history. From its inception, NCI served as a symbol of accomplishment within African-American community. G.P. Bowser's efforts, as we mentioned yesterday, with the establishment of Silver Point Institute and many other educational endeavors that he was responsible for moving forward, many of them had failed. But NCI did not fail. It was an institute created and financed from its inception by African-American members of Churches of Christ. And NCI succeeded in providing formidable leadership for over 25 years within African-American Churches of Christ. Doug Foster, you may be familiar with Doug. He's done a lot of work in this area and historically within Churches of Christ. He wrote NCI, Southwestern Christian College, and the Christian Echo, along with the National Lectureship, began in 1945. All of these helped create an identity, a sense of solidarity among black Churches of Christ on the eve of one of the most significant events in American history, the Civil Rights Movement. So leading up to the Civil Rights Movement, these entities within black Churches of Christ really helped form an identity for that group. They're very, very important. And of those institutions or ideas, NCI provided the best bridge between African-American and white congregations and individuals within Churches of Christ. So given its ability to help people connect, the question kind of arises, what would happen if it ever went away? We found out in 1967. February of 1967, NCI's board of directors, again, six white, four African-American, at the head of the class is A.M. Burton, who's a white man. They decide to close the school and liquidate its assets. In selling the assets, they consider many possibilities of what to do with the money. Listed in some of the records, here are some of the things they considered. They considered building or adding to ministerial training in other ways, putting that money to resource to education to train ministers. They thought about building an orphan's home. They thought about daycare for children of working mothers. Or they thought about the education of African Americans at other institutions. The board chose this last alternative, though not in the manner that many African Americans would have wanted them to choose. The board voted to take the money from the sale of NCI and to put it into what has been called the Burton Keeble Scholarship Fund at David Lipscomb College. How do you think that went over? Not well. Not well. In the words of Hogan, this decision amounted to robbery, and a phrase that he penned, it was the grab of the century. In the minds of many members of this movement, African Americans especially, the white members of Churches of Christ had stolen their money, their school, and their identity. David Lipscomb College, if you recall, had only recently desegregated, and over 10 years after the Supreme Court mandated that they do so. And now they took the money from the sale of NCI and put it into a scholarship fund at that school. Many African Americans were convinced that the only reason they did this was to receive federal money. So African Americans were very upset, filed an injunction against the board to block the move. Now, interestingly, when I was living in Nashville working on this project, went up to the records in the federal courthouse and found this case. And I think one of the most telling pieces, you just think about the symbolism here of how this case is listed in the federal records. The plaintiffs in this case are listed as Negro members of the Churches of Christ and alumni, patriots, and students of NCI. And the accused in this case are listed as white members of Churches of Christ. So this was Civil War, folks. this was African-American against whites within churches. That's how it's listed in the law books. And they retained as their attorney the very, by this time, very famous alumnus, Fred Gray, who at this time was Martin Luther King Jr.'s attorney. And he agreed to work simply from donations given from the African-American community. Despite this high-profile attorney, neither the injunction nor the appeal succeeded in blocking the actions of NCI's board. And I've heard Fred Gray say this, that he and other people that were responsible for this case, they never in their wildest dream believed this would succeed. They just wanted to be heard. They did not want this to go unnoticed. They wanted this to be as public as it could possibly be. And so that's what they did. They never thought that they would win, and they didn't. But they wanted everyone to know that what had happened was wrong. This single event, this court case and its aftermath, I think more than any other thing, shattered the illusion of racial unity within Churches of Christ. If people thought this was a united movement before, those dreams were shattered here. That illusion was destroyed. Here, deep-seated resentment that had been there for a long time, it spilled to the surface. Foster Doug had a conversation with one of those people involved in this case and in this event several years ago. I want you to listen to how he described it. You can kind of see where the resentment came from. This individual said, for all those years, talking to Doug as a white member of the movement, said, for all those years, you refused to allow any of us to attend your school. Then you took by force and against our will one of the only rallying points we had. You let it be swallowed up in your multi-million-dollar operation, and then you say to us, you can come over here and be like us now. We still don't particularly value your culture or your history or the way you live, act, and worship, but you can come over here with us as long as you do just like we do. And then he asked Doug, can you understand the resentment expressed at this act? Even if the school had to close, and there are debates on whether it should have closed or not, but even if it did have to close, Fred Gray and other alumni of the school would have hoped that the money would have been collected and given to Southwestern Christian College, which was an African-American school that was in its infancy in that period, which was designed to fulfill the same purpose. But it wasn't. Southwestern Christian College is still the only remaining African-American Churches of Christ college within this movement. NCI closed. The board did not send it to Southwestern. The money, they established the Burton Keeple Scholarship Fund at Lipscomb. And Churches of Christ, among many other things, lost a very viable connection to the African-American part of the movement. And the impact of that event, I don't think, can be overestimated. I believe that that case, which is Liz's Ellie versus Pulleas, the president of Lipscomb at that time, or the CEO there, created two separate fellowships where there had been one. G.P. Holt, another leader within the movement, wrote just 2 years after that case, and I think these were prophetic words. He said, "Brethren, I do not believe that God is happy or pleased with two churches. And believe me, he said, there are two churches of Christ on earth today. There is a white church and there is a black church. And they are growing farther apart every day. Many historians, scholars of this movement, on both sides of the so-called color line, have since agreed with what Holt wrote all those years before. Before this case, there were figures like Burton and Keeble and institutions like NCI and other institutions that, at least in some way, allowed these two racially divided factions to connect. At least a little bit. After 1967, African Americans within Churches of Christ became increasingly separated from white members of Churches of Christ more than ever. African Americans had their own educational institution, Southwestern Christian College, their own journal, Christian Echo, their own lectureships held at Southwest Christian College and other places. And on the other side of the movement, white members of the movement had their own schools. ACC at that time, ACU now, has historically hosted almost exclusively white speakers at their lectureship. Few members of this denomination even know that the Christian Echo exists. And many members from Texas. I live in Tyler, which is about 45 minutes from Terrell, which is where Southwestern is. And I bet if I polled my congregation this Sunday morning, I bet less than half of them would know that Southwestern Christian College even exists. We are very separated in our movement. This disconnection, though somewhat apparent before 1967, formalized, as much as anything can be formalized, we talked about yesterday, that division was formalized in 1967. Now, believe it or not, here's where things really get difficult. For over 30 years now, African-American churches of Christ, white churches of Christ, have existed in parallel universes, completely separate. Physically, they've been separated, rarely overlapping at all. So the question is, well, here we are, all these years later, why can't we just get in the same room, hash all this out, ask for forgiveness, move forward? I mean, we have an African-American president, after all. I mean, haven't we come? Haven't we arrived? Has an America gotten past all of that? I recently took my family to Atlanta. And my wife and I lived there in our, we call them our single years, but they were our pre-kid years. Back when we were in school. They'd never been there. While we were in town, one of the things we did is we took the kids down to the King Center. If you've never been to the King Center, you need to go. It's phenomenal. But one of the things that they did when they were there is they watched some of the videos. If you've ever been there, you see the TV is playing and they show scenes from the Civil Rights Movement. They show King marching in the streets and they show the speeches and they see some of the riots that took place in Birmingham and all the things that we have seen many times. They saw the violence. They saw Jim Crow. And their response to those videos was complete and utter astonishment. They couldn't fathom a world where things like that can happen. They asked a lot of questions. Questions I didn't really have answers for. And at some level, I was pleased by that. They can't envision a world where there's two separate water fountains. They can't envision a world where you're mandated to go to two different schools. They can't comprehend that. So why can't we just put all this behind us? Well, as I said, here's where it gets kind of complicated. In 1999, on ACU's campus, they had the One in Christ Conference. Show of hands, was anybody there? One in Christ Conference? Sometimes when I present this, I have a couple people that were there. White leaders, led by Dr. Royce Money, who was at that time president of ACU, apologized very publicly for the blatant racism of that institution of which he was president. And other institutions within Churches of Christ or their blatant racism against African Americans. Later, those same leaders were invited to the campus of Southwestern Christian College. And in front of that student body, they again apologized for the blatant racism that they had participated in against their African American brothers and sisters. Now, one might be tempted to believe that after that, surely, we can all just get along. But here's the problem. There was a day in that conference where they dealt with all the apologies, all the racism that had taken place, and there were tears, and there were hugs, and there were a lot of conversations that needed to have taken place for decades. And then they got to day two, and here's what they learned: 30 years of physical separation had led to significant theological separation. These movements were in very different places. Now, those of you who heard yesterday can remember kind of the analogy here. Remember how we talked about yesterday when disciples of Christ and churches of Christ split from one another? That the division really took place a long time before 1906, but we have nothing to say we're divided? The same thing happened here. There was nothing to say that African American and white members of this movement had divided from one another, that there were two movements from one another. Nevertheless, we didn't engage one another. So we existed in two parallel universes for over three decades. And as that happened, we grew further and further apart theologically. Now, I'm going to make some generalizations here. This isn't true across the board, but generally speaking, there are two separate biblical hermeneutics at work within many white congregations and African-American congregations. Now, without making any value judgments on which biblical hermeneutic is correct or incorrect, I think it's apparent that there are two different biblical hermeneutics at work within these two movements. And if racial difference is difficult to deal with, try throwing onto that theological difference. So it's been very, very difficult in these years. Jerry Taylor and others, I told you yesterday, I was part of a conference earlier this week in the middle of L.A., and these conferences have continued to take place, trying to get white leaders and African-American leaders in the same room to get to know each other and to deal with some of these things. But it is slow going. It is slow going. And I think one of the reasons for that is it's not just the race question. It's also the theological question. There's significant differences in these two groups. So where do we go from here? Well, I admit that in many cases I am an optimist to a fault. And if I did not believe that there was hope for reconciliation here, I would not be engaging in this conversation. I would not be doing this. I'd be doing something else. But I do believe there is hope. Yesterday I told you, because we're in Southern California, I gave you a Ronald Reagan quotation that I think is very appropriate for historical inquiry. He said, "If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are." And I think that's important in this conversation. There is a part of who we are that is oftentimes forgotten. In the early 19th century, when the Campbell and Stone movements were contemplating a merger, you know, for a long time, Alexander Campbell had his movement over here, and Barton Stone had his movement over here, and they operated in different circles for a very long time. And it wasn't until after a couple of decades where these two movements came to be what we know of as the Restoration Movement, or the Stone-Campbell Movement, or birthed Churches of Christ. But it took a while for those two movements to come together. Now, the reason I bring that up is this. You need to know that on just about every major theological category, Barton Stone and Alexander Campbell disagreed. I mean, almost every major category there was. Think about this. On eschatology, how's the world going to end? Campbell was a postmillennial. Stone was a premillennial. That's about as far apart as you can get. On Christology, Campbell was as close to an Orthodox Trinitarian as one could possibly be without using the name Trinitarian. Stone, on the other hand, believed that Christ was divine, but he was subordinate to the Father. He was not a Trinitarian. Regarding the Holy Spirit, Campbell believed that the Holy Spirit worked only through the written word. Stone, on the other hand, believed the Spirit was active and alive inside of Christian people. Regarding the church, ecclesiology, Campbell favored the name disciple. Stone favored the name Christian. Campbell said that no one could join the church without being immersed. Stone believed in a more open style of church membership. There are even other more personal social issues that separated these two leaders. In terms of socioeconomic condition, Campbell, when he died, was one of the wealthiest people in that part of the country. He was a wealthy landowner. Barton Stone died penniless, and he was almost penniless his entire life. In terms of education, Alexander Campbell was educated at the prestigious University of Glasgow in Scotland. Barton Stone was educated in a small frontier log cabin schoolhouse. And in spite of all of those differences, theological differences, educational differences, socioeconomic differences, inside of all of those things that they had that separated them from one another, these two movements united. And they came together. 1832, January 1st, 1832, Raccoon John Smith. What a name. Raccoon John Smith, representing the Campbell movement, got up before this gathered assembly and made this statement. Said, "Let us then, my brethren, be no longer Campbellites or Stonites, new lights or old lights or any other kind of lights. Let us come to the Bible, and to the Bible alone is the only book of creation that can give us all the light that we need." And those two movements came together. That is who we are. That's what we did. That's in our DNA. And a lot of people have forgotten that. We may not all be alike in color. We may not be all alike in our theology. We are all alike, however, in Christ. And because of that, there's hope. There's a lot of work to be done. But there's hope. I want to say just a couple of things, and I'm going to let you talk for a minute in terms of where do we go from here. One, I want to alert you to some of the stuff that Jerry Taylor's doing. These racial conferences that have been taking place over the last year. Jerry was giving a sabbatical from ACU, and that's really all he's been doing for the last several months. We've had a conference in Atlanta, in Memphis. We had one here in L.A. this week. We have another one in Abilene later this month. Well, beginning of June. And all of these are efforts to try to get people into the same room and talk to each other and get to know each other. Talking about the past, talking about where do we go from here. I think those efforts are important. You need to know about it. If you're in this room, I'm assuming that you care about this issue. And so I want you to know what's taking place. Some of that is taking place. I'll also say this. Pragmatically. Typically, when we try to get folks together, for some reason, within our movement, we had this idea that the first thing we need to do is have a combined worship service. Let's get everybody together and have a big old gospel meeting or, big old worship service down. Let's get all of our African-American and white brothers and sisters in the same room. We can worship together. May I recommend that that's not where we start?
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work, and that may be one of the most difficult places to start. Because we've already said, theologically, we are worlds apart in some ways. I would urge us to start in other places. Why not start in service together? If you're part of the local congregation, once you get on the phone, get to know the people in your own town, and say, hey, let's together do this to serve our community. And allow folks to rub shoulders with each other, get to know each other, be in the same room with each other, and serve together. And sometimes those relationships that grow that way are going to be much more lasting, and you're going to have much less of an uphill climb. That's a place to start. And I would encourage you to do that. All right?